Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and all the ways that immigrants make our food system more delicious. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. My guest today is Manal Kahi. She's the founder of Eat Offbeat, a catering company staffed by refugee chefs. At Eat Offbeat, the chefs prepare recipes they've carried with them from their native countries, places like Syria, Nepal, Eritrea, and Iraq. The unique dishes are delivered to adventurous New Yorkers interested in trying new foods. Welcome to the show, Manal.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here.
Of course.
So first, we'll be speaking with you a little bit about your own background and your own immigration story. I know you're from Lebanon.
I am.
Correct. So tell us a little bit about when you came over to the United States and what the reasoning behind that was.
Sure. So I'm originally from Lebanon, like you mentioned, a couple, miles away from Beirut, the capital. I came to the U.S., to New York specifically in 2013 to pursue a master's degree in international affairs at Columbia University here in New York. Yeah, basically, when I got here, I was a bit disappointed with hummus on supermarket shelves and grocery stores. You know?
Was that your first reaction to America? You're
not
like, I'm here and I don't like the hummus.
Not necessarily. There were a bunch of different things. My first impression when I first got here was that it felt very familiar. Probably because of all the movies we watch about New York, it didn't feel like I was in such a strange
place.
That's
so surprising to me.
Yeah, it really felt like I was somewhere, you know, it felt like I knew the place. It didn't feel like such a new... place for me.
Did you have TV shows you'd grown up watching that had New York in
probably.
Them?
Probably.
Did you watch
Friends
Sex
is
and the
one
City?
Of them?
Oh, Friends, right.
Exactly, Sex and the City. Yeah, Friends, so many shows.
Not very realistic of New York, unfortunately.
Exactly. But there's a bit of, even if it's not shot in New York, there's a lot of shots that happen in New York. The yellow taxis, the yellow cabs, these things. So it kind of gives you an idea of what to expect, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And what did you come here to study?
International affairs, mm-hmm. with a focus on environment, actually, and energy. That was my background before I came here. So I used to be an environmental consultant back in Beirut. I was consulting for, basically energy and environment issues.
So what in your mind was like the job you were going to end up doing once you graduated?
I really wanted to work on international climate policy or international environmental affairs with, you know, multilateral organizations, working on international deals, something like that. That's what I wanted to do. And that's why I came to New York, actually. I knew that was the place to be, to start the career in that.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly now I'm elsewhere. I'm in a field that's completely different.
It is. So tell us about that. It sounds like something about hummus kind of sidetracked you there.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. It's still a bit, I like to say it's energy. It's still energy. It's just a different type of energy.
Absolutely.
Right? It's energy for the soul. Yeah. Like I was saying, I was disappointed with hummus. I wasn't very happy with the quality I found in grocery stores.
It's hard
and
to compare it.
Yeah. Didn't compare well with what I used to have. Uh-huh. Or let's say I had very high standards when it came to hummus back home. So I started making my own. I basically really just called up my grandmother, asked her, hey, how do you make your hummus? She gave me her recipe. And everyone around me just loved it. People started raving about it. Although, like, deep down, I knew it wasn't even that good, right? Not even as good as my grandmother's.
Not as good as your grandmother's.
Exactly.
But I'm sure.
It was good.
Still, I mean, it was
okay. Just not like the
recipe.
Best. Yeah, exactly. Just not the best hummus I had had.
Right.
But people loved it. And I actually mentioned that to my brother, who's now my co-founder at Eat Offbeat. His name is Wissam. And so he was, I mean, we... Wissam suggested, hey, why don't we find a way to sell it? We should.
Did
find
he have
a
similar experience? Was he like also nostalgic for foods
absolutely.
From Lebanon and from
yeah,
where you're from?
Absolutely. He also was of that opinion that it tasted, I mean, people buy so much hummus here, it's not that good. And so he
people here
that.
Love hummus.
I know.
But I mean, having personally been to the Middle East, like it is such a different product. Like
exactly.
you can't really compare it. They're not the same animal
exactly.
at all.
Exactly. It's a different thing. And yeah. I mean, clearly, I have to be fair. A lot of restaurants here serve really good hummus. Mm-hmm. It's not. But I just mean
but yeah,
the
it's different than like the kind you get at the deli.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, that's kind of where we started thinking we should bring good, authentic hummus to New Yorkers. And we started thinking of who could bring that, who could help us bring that real, authentic hummus, basically.
You're like, I gotta get my grandma here?
More or less. That's kind of where she's a little old, clearly. I'd love to, but that's
put her to work.
That wasn't going to happen. She actually happens to be from Aleppo, from Syria.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Our grandmother. So it was relatively for us, and again, that was 2013, just to give you some context. I had left Lebanon in the midst of what was known as the refugee crisis back in Lebanon. Maybe mm-hmm. it wasn't a thing yet here in the U.S. or in Europe, but for us in Lebanon, we already were kind of suffering with... not suffering, let me rephrase, but we were already exposed to all the suffering that was happening mm-hmm. With mainly Syrian refugees being resettled in Lebanon.
Right, but I think you're right. I don't think that was a term that had sort of made its way yet over to the States.
Exactly,
yeah.
Not yet. It was relatively easy for us to make the connection. Our mother, mm-hmm. grandmother happening to be from Syria, from Aleppo, and then having kind of a little guilt, let's say, about having left Lebanon, not being able to do anything about the entire mm-hmm. situation, being here in the U.S., kind of made sense. Why not have Syrian refugees who are being resettled here in New York make great hummus the way they make it for their families,
yeah.
or my hummus, or yeah. just theirs, the way they make it for their families, and kind of introduce New Yorkers to it? Because I was sure there was going to be tons of people who make even better hummus than mine. It was never the intention to sell my own hummus.
Right.
It was more the intention to sell theirs, to find those people who make great hummus and sell it.
Right. I mean, nor were you a chef or
exactly.
you know, pursuing a culinary career.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, anecdotally, when we first got the idea, I had a friend who asked me to cater an event for them. Not even cater, just provide some hummus for their event. And I had to spend about an entire day making hummus. And it wasn't fun, to be honest. It was a lot of work. By the end of the day, I couldn't taste hummus anymore. I couldn't taste it. So that was part of the reasoning behind, towards the end, we switched. We kind of pivoted away from just hummus and thought, why not make it more global? There are so many other countries that have cuisines that are underrepresented. We, both myself and Wissam, my brother, were very adventurous. Anyway, we like discovering new cuisines, so we thought, why not look for other recipes? There must be other recipes just like hummus that are way better if they're homemade, made with love, you know, based on family recipes versus bought at the stores, or even, you know, discovered. Hummus probably wasn't a great example, because hummus is so common and people in New York just know it, everyone knows it, mm-hmm. but there are so many other recipes that we don't know. For instance, I mean, hummus, everyone knows it here. Nobody knows about, maybe less people know baba ganoush, which is the kind of the equivalent with eggplants. But there's another dish which my grandma is famous for, which is called mhamara in Arabic. And that's a dish which is delightful. And I don't find it here anywhere. It's made with basically paprika, nuts, ground nuts, and different seasoning. It's a bit like hummus as a concept, so it's also kind
like
of a dip.
Yeah.
And you usually eat it with bread, pita bread. So we thought, to cut to the chase, there are other recipes that are great and that we thought New Yorkers could discover too. And clearly we kept the idea of hiring refugees, people who are home cooks, not necessarily trained as professional chefs, but those people who are talented enough, just like I always keep my grandmother in mind, because she's one of those people whom everything she makes is amazing, right? The food she made back home is just like, that's some of the best food I've ever had, and she's clearly never had any kind of professional training.
When you explain it, like when you came up with your concept, it seems so obvious and like such a, like it's so straightforward to connect those dots between like refugees who might need employment or looking mm-hmm. for some sort of
right.
you know, culinary work, and then being able to provide New Yorkers who are sort of, you know, inherently adventurous eaters. It's like it's such a slam dunk. Like, it's almost amazing that no one was doing it.
Exactly. I'm sure a lot of people had that idea, too.
Well, maybe no one executed it as well as you did.
Yeah, it's also tough to make that jump. But I guess, yeah, clearly, for us, it made sense. It was just something that
made sense. It makes sense for everyone. It's, like, such a win-win.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's a win-win. I mean, people are happy getting a job, especially the fact... I mean, usually when you're hiring people who like cooking, for them, it's a job they like to do, right? It's not, and that's why we focus on that aspect of creating quality jobs. It's jobs. I mean, I myself am really driven by passion. Whatever I'm doing as a job, it has to be something I like. Otherwise, you know, like I probably get depressed. So we really try to focus on that and always recruit people who want to be in a kitchen, who want to be cooking, because that reflects first on the product. It reflects on people. If they're doing something they like to be doing, that I mean, that's great for everyone. It's good for the company. It's good for them, too.
Yeah. It's almost like a triple win, though, too. So it's like it's providing jobs that people really enjoy. It's providing New Yorkers with really delicious food. And then it's also giving people the opportunity to support refugees.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's win-win-win.
Win-win-win.
We have like a slam dunk sound effect or something. So tell us about how you made the transition. Like you had the concept and then how did it actually come to be?
Yeah, that took a long time, let's say. But to summarize it, one of the first steps we did was reach out to the IRC, the International Rescue Committee. And that, again, took a long time in terms of establishing that partnership. And to give you a bit of context, the IRC are one of 9 resettlement agencies here in the U.S. So they basically help refugees resettle from their home countries to New York or wherever they decide to resettle in the U.S., and part of that process entails helping them find jobs or find employment. So we reached out to them initially for validation. We wanted to see with them whether they thought this was a good idea or not. And clearly they did. Mm-hmm. And to this day, they still help us recruit, actually. They're one of the agencies that are helping us recruit people today, mainly chefs.
So basically you let them know you were looking for employees and then they suggested, said, we have these individuals. And did all those people, were they all chefs before?
None of them.
In their countries? Okay.
None of them. I mean, today maybe out of 18 chefs, maybe 2 or 3 had previous experience working in restaurants, either as chefs or in restaurants. Otherwise, everyone else, no, they really don't have any previous training or experience in restaurants, but they are all talented home cooks, let's say.
So how does that work? I mean, they had recipes that they just, you know, knew from memory or that they'd grown up with eating. What was the transition process to turn it to make it like sustainable, I guess, for a delivery concept?
Yeah, so maybe here I should mention that our third partner, Chef Juan, he's our head chef. He's the chief culinary officer at the company, actually. And he's the person who, first of all, recruits the chef. So he's the one who decides whether one person, you know, has the talent or not. And so far...
Is it like an audition? Is it like going on
Chopped? Kind of. Yeah, yeah. It feels like chefs... what do you call that show?
Like Iron Chef or something.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of how it goes. We have everyone come to the kitchen.
There's a gauntlet.
We have all the ingredients and they kind of start making something. And Juan, who has experience working for Mission Star restaurants, you know, he has a long experience working in restaurants, including Per Se or El Bulli, some of these top-notch restaurants all over the world. So he's the one who tastes whatever the candidates make, and he can feel whether they would make a great... Knowing that the skills are something to be acquired moving forward. I mean, clearly, once you have that talent, it's easier to get the skills.
Yeah, he's looking for potential.
Exactly, he's looking for potential. And he's the one then training them on how to move in a professional kitchen. It's different from in your home kitchen. How to scale their recipes from a small cooking for 10, 15 people to 200 or 300. Hygiene standards, New York standards, all these things. So making sure we go according to top, you know, hygiene standards, all these things. And then even clearly choosing those recipes that are good for deliveries, making sure we're the menus are coordinated, balanced, all these things.
So how does that work? Because I imagine there's people speaking, some people don't speak English. There's people speaking all different languages, all working in the same kitchen.
Yeah, we have 11 different countries represented today, I think, at the kitchen. And most of them speak at least basic English. So that's good because they live here. So they live in New York. Those who have been resettled in like less than 2 or 3 months ago, usually have a very, very basic English. But that has never been a challenge for us at the kitchen. Although initially we thought that was going to be challenging, but somehow people just communicate, especially for the chefs. The only position where we actually do need some level of English fluency is with delivery people who go out and make deliveries. Simply because they need to communicate with the security people, with the taxi driver or the drivers, or get directions, something like that. That's the only position where we actually require some level of English fluency. Otherwise, at the kitchen, that's never been a challenge. People just communicate. We like to say
the language of food.
Exactly. Yeah. We like to say that. But somehow, I don't know how it happens. I've actually seen it happening in front of me. I think because they get used to each other, they start speaking in different languages, and everyone understands. Or sometimes because I'm from Lebanon, I speak in Arabic sometimes to chefs who the chef who comes from Iraq, for instance. We speak in Arabic, and sometimes I'm speaking to her in Arabic and I see the chef from Nepal, for instance, nodding and saying yeah. So she understands. I don't know how they do it, but it kind of happens. Language is not an issue.
Well, okay, so what are issues? What have been the biggest challenges to come out of the operations?
So clearly, I mentioned delivery.
Yeah.
Delivery logistics has been one of the most challenging things, especially in the beginning, finding the right... especially in a city like New York, where you have to... I mean, traffic is always unpredictable. Ensuring that you're there on time, every time, making sure you're doing it at a cost-effective, in a cost-effective manner. So definitely delivery logistics have been challenging. And again, like I mentioned, it's a little harder to recruit people to do deliveries than chefs at the kitchen. And that, again, was one of the surprises, let's say, because you would think that's the easier part of the job, and somehow it's not, because it's not easy in New York to find your way. You need to know how to use your phone, you need to know how to navigate. Security people are not always the nicest when you want to go inside the fancy apartment.
It can be challenging for people who have lived there their whole lives.
Exactly, absolutely. Yeah. It's challenging for myself, so it's not, I mean, not that I'm, but yeah, definitely, it's challenging.
Yeah, and I know there's been some cross-pollination with some of the recipes, different confluences of countries. Does that happen organically? Like, what's been the process?
More or less. Some things happened organically. For instance, you have our Nepali chef, for instance, is vegetarian. She always makes momos or dumplings that are vegetarian. Our Iraqi chef loves to cook with beef. Everything she makes has beef or something meaty. She likes meat. So she used to make a lot of momos with Rashana. Now she knows how to make, with our Nepali chef. And at some point, she told us, I think, back at the kitchen, she told us, last weekend I made them for my kids. I made a beef version for my kids. So she made momos that are Nepali. She filled them with an Iraqi filling inside, which had beef. And the result, we had her, we said, oh, great, we want to try that. We tried it, and it was actually very delicious. You could feel the taste inside. You could feel the spices from the Middle East, and on the outside, you could feel, again, the Asian flavors, let's say, or at least texture. So it made a very really nice combination. So that's one of the organic things that happened, and there's a bunch of other examples like that.
I love that there's people that are immigrating to America, but they're learning... who have come to America, but they're learning about other countries.
Absolutely.
Because they're cooking in the kitchen with people from, like you said, 11 different countries.
Yeah, and most of them actually now cook some of these recipes for their families. So even their families have learned cuisines from all over, and I think they enjoy it.
So I have to ask, because it's a kitchen that's staffed by refugees, and just because of the political climate that we're in now, I imagine that's been an issue. The first immigration ban was announced on January 31st. How has that, if it has affected at all, how has it changed things or not changed things?
Yeah. I wouldn't say it did not affect us. It did affect us. If anything, it affected us positively, actually.
And
I can tell you exactly. And especially in a city like New York, I think people really want to do something about it. And we felt that. So I can walk you through the process of what happened to us.
Please do. Yeah.
Right after the ban, actually, or at least the day it happened, I can tell you about my personal experience. I kind of felt, vulnerable with everything that was happening. I think it was a Sunday, so I wasn't at the kitchen. We were not at the kitchen. I didn't know what the chefs were going through, but I knew for sure that it could have been one of us, could have been one of the chefs, could have been anyone stuck on those airports or who can't come back to the US, let's say. And as an immigrant, I just felt vulnerable. Even as a business too, we felt like, oh, what are we going to do? But then it took, I mean, very quickly we realized that people started flooding to the airports, to protest. So it felt like people, especially in New York, they had our backs, right? We didn't feel like we were alone. And very quickly that feeling kind of turned into more determination, I would say. We just felt, okay, that only means that we need to keep doing what we're doing. If anything, we need to do it even better and even faster, right? So the only way it did affect us is that it made us more determined to keep doing what we were doing. The other thing is actually that our sales right after the ban, they doubled. So orders doubled. People wanted to do something. They were hearing about us and they felt, oh, great. That's one of the ways I could kind of show that I stand with immigrants. I stand with refugees. I think that was really clear. In our numbers, you can see that people wanted to take a stand.
Has that sustained?
Yeah, it has.
That's so nice.
So far, it has. I mean, we cannot correlate it exactly to why or anything. Most of our sales anyway come through word of mouth, so clearly when it first started, it has it ended up affecting our sales today clearly, but in that month definitely it was very clearly related to the ban.
How did it feel to you as a business owner? I mean, you are an immigrant, but you are also, you know, someone who is largely responsible for the welfare of, you know, over 10 refugee women. Did you feel any sort of personal responsibility to, I don't know, comfort your employees or try and assure them or give them any reassurance in any way?
Not necessarily. I mean, first of all, because there was nothing I could do.
Yeah.
It was such a legal... I thought if anyone could do anything, it was lawyers or attorneys. Mm-hmm. I really had nothing to do. And if anything, I felt... I mean, we were all in the same bucket. Yeah. I could have been thrown
out
too.
For sure.
So not necessarily. I didn't feel like there was anything I could do, and that's part of why I felt so vulnerable, actually, because there was nothing I could do for our business. There was nothing I could have done for myself or even for the chefs. So and that's part of why it felt really depressing.
It must be really complicated to feel, you know, so proud to be in New York right now and feel so much support around you. I mean, it feels complicated to me as a New Yorker, and I'm not even in the same position, just to feel so much allegiance with my city, you know, on that city level, but feel so disillusioned and sort of betrayed on a national level.
Yeah, but at the same time, I feel like a lot of people are speaking out in New York or even outside of New York. You're familiar, maybe we'll talk about that later. We were on Kickstarter 2 months ago, and people from all over the U.S. contributed, and they sent us messages. So it's not only in New York. Clearly, in New York, there's a bigger...
You really feel that kind of divide.
We do feel that everywhere. I mean, we do feel that a lot of people are supporting us, and that's kind of what keeps us going.
Yeah. How are all of your, if you want to speak to this, any of your employees kind of managing, or has anything affected anyone personally in your kitchen?
I don't think so. Nothing that we've heard. I think so far, yeah. And again, this is New York. It may be different from other places. I'm not sure. But we haven't heard of anything. So far, I think people are peaceful.
Yeah. Has anyone reached out to you just like in the New York community? And I mean, obviously you're seeing the support through numbers, but like, have there been any sort of personal experience where you've delivered food and people have expressed that this is a way for them to feel like, you know, they're making an impact or doing something helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. Either during the delivery or while people are placing the order, a lot of people do mention that they feel like they're doing something. But also a lot of people come simply for the food because they want to enjoy the food.
Well, again, it's
for us, that's
win-win.
More important. Yeah. Exactly. For us, that's the most important thing. I think we haven't addressed that. We didn't talk about that in the beginning. But we really try. I mean, clearly, we are hiring people who are refugees by status. We try to focus a lot on the fact that they are chefs by nature, that the refugee thing is just a status for them. It's just, you know, maybe I came here as a student visa, but no one calls me student visa holder, right? Yeah. We really want people to start seeing our chefs for who they are beyond their status, beyond that visa situation, or beyond, you know, why they came to the U.S. And that's really the whole point for us, kind of start to see. And it's challenging, I know, because at the same time, we have to kind of... you know, say what we're doing. But for us, the ultimate goal is to really help people start seeing beyond beyond the status. Start seeing our chefs.
Well, can you speak to that? I mean, how is that sort of happening in real time? I mean, I imagine like having this profession and being part of such a wonderful company is a really empowering experience.
Yeah, hopefully. I hope it is. And I think it is actually for the chefs, for all of us, everyone at the company. But definitely having the chance to cook your food, have people taste your food and then tell you, wow, it's amazing. It makes you feel so proud. And we've seen that with our chefs. It just, people are not, you know, we've had one of the chefs actually this was the first time I didn't have to adapt, because your whole life as an immigrant, sometimes you're adapting to something else. At Eat Off Beat, it's the other way around. It's New Yorkers who are
really
adapting
to
their cooking, and it's not the other way around. And I think that's one of the most powerful things, let's say. And the other major shift that we try to focus on is the fact that for us, we're not a charity. That's another thing we haven't mentioned. We're a for-profit. Our employees are regular employees, mm-hmm. just like everyone else. They pay their taxes. They, they fill their... just like any other employee. So for us, that's very important, because people need also to see that they don't necessarily need any charity. It's not a charity. They don't need your help. For us, it's really the other way around. It's them helping New Yorkers discover something new. It's Eat Off Beat helping New Yorkers discover all these amazing cuisines that they haven't had the chance to try anywhere else. So it's really about shifting perspectives.
Yeah. I want to share something with you, if that's okay.
Of course.
Full disclosure, a couple months ago, I wrote an article about your company for Food 52. And so I had the chance to be in the kitchen. And I met several of the chefs. And one of them, I'm not sure what her name was, because she had just started. I think she was very, very new at the time. But she was telling me that before she came to the United States, she knew that she couldn't bring a lot with her. But in a suitcase, she was going to pack food. She was going to bring, I think, dried pasta of some sort. And she told me that no matter what, she wouldn't have a lot to bring with her, but she knew that she'd be meeting new people and she would at least have her food. And she might not speak the language, but she could introduce herself through cooking. And that just touched me so much, because it really made me realize that, you know, food was a way, it was going to keep her kind of grounded in who she was, but it was also a way to identify yourself and potentially enterprise, which people are doing now through Eat Off Beat, and just use it as a bridge and just access this new culture. And it's a way, it's that language of food that you touched upon before. And I just thought that was so lovely. I wanted to share that story. We're going to take a quick break for a commercial, and then we'll be back to talk more, Manal.
Perfect.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Well, there were three babies born, one of them couldn't see.
Hey, you're listening to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I'm in studio with my guest, Manal Kahish. She's the founder of Eat Off Beat, which is a food delivery and catering company that employs refugees. So we just learned a little bit about the company, and I know you recently had a Kickstarter for a cookbook.
We did, yeah.
That was very successful.
It was.
Congratulations.
Thank you. The Kickstarter actually ran in March, between March and April, for 1 month.
So where are you at in the process? Does this mean there's going to be a cookbook coming soon?
Of course.
Yay!
There is going to be a cookbook where we've started working on it, clearly. So we fundraised for it. We crowdfunded for it over March and April. We had over close to 2,000 backers, I think, from all over the world.
That's amazing.
From over 45 countries,
wow.
Actually, including the U.S. The vast majority was in the U.S., but there were also people from countries all over. And yeah, the main idea was to actually create a cookbook which will feature our chefs, their recipes and their stories, and kind of really keep with our mission of highlighting all the value that that our chefs are bringing, and really, like I was mentioning, helping people see our chefs beyond their status of refugees and really for who they are, who they want, the story they want to tell. We always say, you know, for us, one of the ultimate goals is to kind of change the narrative around refugees and show a different story. So that's why it was only natural for us to produce a cookbook. What better way, right, to rewrite the narrative than to actually write a new one?
So what kind of stories were they sharing, if not ones of their, you know, personal kind of tale, yeah, of being a refugee and immigrating?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there's a lot that defines a person that goes to every single mm-hmm. person. And there's a lot that defines you. It doesn't necessarily have to be why you came here or the way you came here, but also can be, you know, the type of gardens you had in front of your house, the kind of smells you had in front of your house, what you used to cook, what was your inspiration, where you learned cooking, your favorite dish, what your ambitions are, where you're planning to go. There's so many other things that every,
yeah, and so it's really just kind of whatever they wanted to share about themselves.
Exactly.
Are you one of the cooks in the cookbook?
No.
Are we going to hear your story as
I don't
well?
Think so. We haven't decided yet if we're going to have the hummus recipe.
I think
in
the hummus,
there.
I would love to get that hummus recipe.
Maybe.
I want that recipe.
We can share that. Okay. Honestly, I'm not sure yet, because clearly I'm not nearly as good as anyone else at the kitchen. So I don't think.
So is it 11 different countries that are being represented
at
in
least,
the cookbook?
At least. We're promising 15.
Oh, wow. Actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like it's going to be a really delicious book to have.
Absolutely.
When can we get this book?
So we're probably going to have it ready within a year to a year and a half from today.
Mm-hmm.
We're on it. We're doing our best to have it published as soon as possible. And in the meantime, clearly for all our backers, those who have backed our campaign, there will be a bunch of different surprises along the way. We don't want to make them wait too long. So
yeah,
there will be a bunch
hopefully
of different
treats
things
arriving in the mailbox.
Exactly, yeah. I won't tell you too much,
okay,
but there will be a little, like a few things in the meantime, because we know it's a long time to wait. We're working very hard on it, but there will be a few.
It's going to be worth the wait.
Definitely.
Yeah.
We're confident.
And what else? Are you growing the company right now?
We are. Right now, for us, the focus is to grow here in New York. Keep growing. I mean, New York is a huge market in and by mm-hmm. itself, but we'd love to at some point go elsewhere too, explore other markets and see other cities where there are a lot of adventurous eaters who also would like to discover all these amazing new cuisines. And we've already received a lot of demand, actually, a lot of emails from people all over saying, oh, when are you coming to my city? So we would love that. We would love for that to happen, but that's going to happen not right now, let's mm-hmm. say. For us right now, it's really about proving our model, making sure, growing a little further here in New York, structuring everything, and
creating new recipes, I'm sure.
That
in the
too,
meantime.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Or at least creating systems so those recipes could create themselves
yeah.
in the future.
And I have to say to everyone out there, the food is so good. I mean, it's like, it's such a wonderful concept and you want to immediately get on board because of it, but like the food sells itself.
Yeah, well, thanks for saying that.
Yeah.
But absolutely. We do have a very high repeat customer rate today
mm-hmm.
and that really shows that people, I mean, usually you might come once because you're intrigued, you want to support, but you wouldn't order again if you were not really enjoying the food.
I'm still thinking about that Manchurian cauliflower.
Amazing.
Like
that's one of the best sellers.
And like spicy and a little sweet, and it is so good.
Yeah.
So tell us, who can order from Eat Offbeat? How does that work?
So we deliver to groups of 10 people and more all over New York City. So wherever you are in New York City, we would deliver for
it's
you
like
as long as
perfect for companies having lunch.
Exactly. Companies having lunch, nonprofits or universities organizing mm-hmm. events. We've done events for up to 800, 900 people. So any size we would do. And even individuals, anyone who's hosting at least 10 people over.
So a party. So
any dinner party, yeah. anyone, but mostly companies. Usually we find that companies enjoy our offering a lot because it's very quickly set up. Cleanup is super easy too, so we usually deliver. We found a way to mainstream, if you want.
I love the way that the menu is set up online because you really don't have to make choices. So if there's that many people, it's like there's already different kind of menus that are assembled.
Exactly.
That just give you kind of like a whole cross section of all the different kinds of food. So you just get to... You get to try everything.
Exactly. And that's where our head chef comes in terms of making sure that those set menus are really contain everything you would
need. Oh, he's good at that.
Yeah. And we always make sure to have a dish from... Sorry. Different dishes from all over. So a typical menu
right.
will
so
have...
Right. So nice not to choose.
Exactly. And but you would still have like a salad from Iraq, a side dish from Syria, an entree from Nepal, and then another side dish from Eritrea in one menu. So you would get to taste all of these
places. Global party every time.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that also sets us apart from other restaurants or ethnic restaurants, mm-hmm. because here really in one meal you get to try all of these places from different continents, sometimes from four
I'm
different continents.
I'm getting so hungry just thinking about it. So where do we go to order the food?
So you can go on our website, eatoffbeat.com. And you can directly find the, you know, go and order now. You can place your order directly online.
Perfect. Well, Manal, thank you so much. It's been so lovely to have you and just hear about all the wonderful success that Eat Offbeat is experiencing. And it's just such a wonderful concept. I'm so happy that it exists. And
thank
that
you
it's
for
doing
having
so
us.
Well. Of course, you're always welcome here. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio, and we'll see you next week, same time, Wednesday, 5 p.m.
Listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.